It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your show host, Randy Fine. What are we born to do? Should we do what is expected of us or forge our own path in life? Today's special guest, psychologist and psychoanalyst J. Herman Kleiger, explores these questions and more in his debut historical novel, The Eleventh Inkblot. The Eleventh Inkblot is a well-written and lovingly embroidered novel that is spellbindingly measured narrative that entertains and enthralls. This is said by Kirkus Reviews, which is one of the better reviews that you can get. It is a novel that explores a mind torn between art and science, the horrors of war, and the invention of the Rorschach test. The Eleventh Inkblot invites the reader to become a passenger on a moving, interpretive journey of loss, madness, acceptance, and redemption. J. Herman Kleiger was born and raised in Colorado. He graduated from Harvard and the University of Denver before serving as a psychologist in the Navy. A clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst, his major works include Disordered Thinking and the Rorschach in 1999, Assessing Psychosis with Ali Khadaivi in 2015, and Rorschach Assessment of Psychotic Phenomena, 2017. The Eleventh Inkblot is Jim's first novel, and it is so great. So let's get started. Good morning, Jim. Welcome.
Good morning, Randy. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Well, you know, I love all things that have to do with the mind, and so that's why this fascinated me so much. And your book, The Eleventh Inkblot, it's interesting. You know, when I heard the title, it's like, oh, well, what could that possibly mean? But when you read the book, it tells you basically the story of what that is, and it weaves a story into how the Rorschach test actually got started. So can you give us a brief overview of what this story is? I know the main character is Anton.
Sure. As you mentioned, I think when we spoke earlier, it is a historical fiction. It's a coming of age story. There are hints of some magical realism. The story is written as a fictional memoir about this man's life, Anton Zelinsky. And it begins in his early life. Actually, it begins with a very brief prologue where Anton, who's now an old man, says that he's finally going to begin writing about his life. And his life is full of mystery and intrigue, the kinds of things that a small child is left wondering about when he views his parents, his father, a gruff, mechanically minded horologist, a watchmaker. And his mother, and by the way, this is set in the Ukraine, in the early, a small village at the turn of the 20th century, just before, decade or so before World War I. And his mother is a very curious figure. She doesn't seem to fit with the surroundings. She dresses differently. She wears long scarves, flowing skirts, And one of her interests, she's a Romani, as we come to find out later, but she likes to use ink blots to tell fortunes, to see if she can understand things about people, which is actually something that is part of the prehistory of ink blot usage in the Rorschachs. It was used. Ink blots were used in many different ways. And the story basically takes him through the course of his life as he tries to put together the pieces of the things that don't make sense. There's some profound losses. There is the trauma of war as he gets tangled up in the horrible Battle of Tannenberg in World War I, after which he's a broken young man, has descended into a state of madness, and decides that he's going to search for his mother, whom he lost very early in his life under very mysterious circumstances. So that basically sets the path for his journey, where he meets a number of quirky characters, and eventually his path leads him to the storied sanitarium in Switzerland called the Burgholzli Clinic. And through that process, he eventually meets Hermann Rorschach, who is in the process of working on his Rorschach experiment, developing the ink blots and so forth. And so it's a journey across time in this young man's life, and first and foremost, a journey of integration and healing, self-discovery and healing, self-forgiveness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. True. And he also meets Carl Jung. Carl Jung. He also meets Carl Jung. So the 11th ink blot, I just want to share that, because what happened was his mother, they called her gypsy witch, because she was just strange. She was spiritual. She was, you know, reading people's minds and fortunes and things like that. And his father was an very, very angry man. And he burnt all his mother's artwork and all the ink blots. But Anton found one and saved it and carried it with him. Didn't he carry it throughout his life?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. He carried that along with a couple of his father's watches. And again, his father, you mentioned that his mother was a very strange woman. She was strange in the context of this shtetl, this small village called Zastavia, where he lived. And everybody was very, the colors were very earth tone, dour. And she was this flamboyantly dressed character who didn't fit at all. And part of the mystery is, how did she get there? What was she doing there? How did she and his father get together? Because they were as opposite as they could be. And the father gets enraged because she's an embarrassment. He goes away and comes back and discovers that she's got this room full of people watching her move the ink blots around. And he becomes enraged. He burns them all. But Anton sees that there is one that did not make it into the fire, and he does keep that. And when he eventually leaves his home in anger, this is after his mother's disappeared, he does take that with him, and he does carry that with him. Not sure why. He's not sure why he's carried it with him. But it just seemed like it was an important thing to do. And he also carries a watch with him that he was going to make for his papa. And there was a very disillusioning event that occurred with his father and his older brother that made Anton decide to leave home in his late teens. And that's
when he ends up. Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that's where he ends up in a kind of an accidental conscript in the Imperial Russian Army.
It is such a fascinating story, so intriguing. Page turner, definitely a page turner.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really, really well written. What was I going to say? I lost my train of thought. Well, anyway, that is, and tell us how related that is to the actual story of Rorschach. And I know that you took artistic liberty when you were writing this story. So, I know what I wanted to say. I want to back up. What interests me in the beginning is the dynamic between Chaim, his older half-brother, and his father and him. This, and because I focus most of my work on narcissistic abuse, it was interesting that you named Chaim the golden child, because that is one of the aspects of narcissistic abuse in a family. And so Anton was definitely the scapegoat child, and he was the invisible child, and his father just didn't care about him, just didn't want him around, and Chaim could do no wrong. So
yes.
That fascinated me, you know, as far as that.
Well, the relationship that the father, who incidentally is named Herman. There are several Hermans. Obviously, the Herman Rorschach is kind of the good father, and Anton's own father, Herman Zelinsky, was involved in a very much of a narcissistic relationship with his son Chaim. And the relationship between father Chaim and Anton really mirrors the relationship that Herman had with his own father, Israel Zelinsky, who had a favored son named Hyman. And we learn that Herman, Anton's father, was very neglected as a child and was living to try to get his father's approval. And so he repeated that with his sons. And again, I think the reader sort of has this this sense in the early parts of the book that this is a father with two sons who are half brothers. And then as the story evolves, one kind of wonders really who was Anton to what was the connection between Anton and his father Herman. But Herman, the father, treated Chaim very much as a narcissistic kind of self-object.
Mm-hmm.
That he did not see Chaim for who he was. And Chaim finally kind of disavowed his father because of that. But yes, he idealized Chaim, and he devalued Anton. Anton is this swarthy, dark-haired, dark-complected boy who, again, just doesn't fit in this family or village.
Yes, thank you for elaborating on that, because, as I said, I picked up on that dynamic and found that interesting. And I wanted to point that out because my audience is largely people who are tackling this horrible abuse, and so there I wanted to bring that reference to it. So, all right, so then I asked you before I switched and interrupted you, how closely does this story resemble the true story of how the Rorschach inkblot actually came to be?
It does in some important ways. I embellish things. Hermann Rorschach was a real figure. He was a Swiss psychiatrist. Came from a family. His father was an artist, and Hermann went to medical school. He married a Russian woman who was also a physician. He trained at the Berkholzli, but then went to a county canon hospital in Curaçao. It was a little country hospital, so he wasn't at this major institution. He trained there at the Berkholzli. But characters like Bleuler, Eugen Bleuler, was an iconic figure in psychiatry in the early 19th or 20th century. He actually coined the term schizophrenia, which before then had been referred to as dementia praecox, but he was the one that came up with that term. And of course, Carl Jung is a real figure who probably is known better than any of these other figures. And Rorschach was doing research with inkblots. There was a lot of research going on at the Berkholzli and in the scientific community. And Jung was more interested in a word association test. And Rorschach had been dabbling in inkblots, trying to find out what inkblots could tell us about the organization of a person's mind. So he developed this test over time with many, many, many inkblots, 40 or more inkblots. They weren't random. He worked very hard because the inkblots, and I think I mentioned this in the book in one of the quotes attributed to him, they needed to look enough like something, but not too much. So if they were just a mess, then people couldn't really do much interpretive work with them. On the other hand, if they looked too much like something real, then that didn't leave enough room for the play of the mind. So he eventually settled for 10 inkblots, which really, I guess, is a very important point because my story is called the 11th inkblot, and the Rorschach test itself, as it's been used for the last 100 years, has 10 standard inkblots, the same ones. So Rorschach published his book, and it's called Psychodiagnostics. It was published in 1921. It was not well received by the scientific community. And he died a year later at the age of 37.
Wow.
And the book tells of that he died of I believe it was a ruptured appendix that they could not repair in time to save him. So he died at a very early age. The character of Rorschach that I portray in the book really was described in a wonderful book by an author named Damien Searles called Inkblots that really tells almost in a biographical manner about the life of Rorschach, his professional life, his family life, and kind of the legacy of the Rorschach test. Cyril's really described Rorschach, Herman Rorschach, as a mensch, as a man ahead of his time. He was had a lot of feminist values and really believed that that women should be trained as physicians. So again, I probably embellished because of my own sort of wishes to see him as a very good and nurturing figure. How well that fits the actual character, I'm not sure, but it was fun to imagine that.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. So you've done a lot of writing and research into Herman Rorschach and his life and his work. What got you interested in that?
Well, I 40 years ago, as a graduate student, I was first introduced to the Rorschach test, and I was fascinated by it then. And after graduate school, after I'd been in the Navy for a while, I had the opportunity of going to the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, that had a very, very storied history of psychoanalytic thinking and humane treatment and training psychologists in the use of instruments like the Rorschach. I trained there. I lived for a number of years after my training. When I got out of the Navy, I went back and lived for another 10 years in Topeka and had a sort of a very loving network of friends and others who shared these interests, and continued to teach and practice and write about the Rorschach, particularly its value in helping us understand disturbances in thinking and reasoning and perception, and basically helping us learn things, discover things about someone that they had a hard time seeing or understanding about themselves. A lot of my background is in psychological evaluations using instruments like the Rorschach to try to answer questions.
With those inkblot tests, are there typical responses both in various that reveal various states of mind or thought processes? So are there ones that are often that people often respond to, you know? So there's one that looks kind of like a butterfly. Are there typical responses that you get?
Sure. Yes, there are. Typical responses that are actuarially based over the years, giving the procedure to or the test to thousands and thousands of subjects. You begin to see which types of images are more common typical, and which are very unusual and not at all common.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of what would someone see that was not necessarily a positive image, or I don't know what word to use, but so, I use the word butterfly.
Well,
so what would someone see in that picture that would indicate that there was something going on?
Well, you want someone to taking the test to appreciate the fact that we're asking them to represent something, because really these are ink blots. They aren't supposed to be anything, and there are no right or wrong answers. So we would part of an assumption in going into a test like the Rorschach is that the respondent understands that this is an kind of an as-if experience, that these are not real pictures. You know, sometimes people might say, well, what is this supposed to be? What is it really? And it's not. It's up for you to decide. And so we'd like somebody to balance the objective features of the ink blot with images that they have in their own mind. If the images they have in their own mind overrun the appreciation for the reality of the contours of the blot, then that might be a problem. If somebody looks at a blot and responds in a highly personalized way, or gives you a response that doesn't match the contours of the blot. You mentioned just sort of hypothetically, if somebody saw a butterfly, and let's say that might be a very common response on a certain card. If somebody looks at that and they don't tell you that they see this thing that most other people see, but instead tell you that it reminds them of a train station, or it reminds them of their uncle's left foot, or something very, very bizarre,
okay.
where there's really no correspondence between the contours of the blot.
Okay.
And it departs a great deal from what most other people see, and it's embellished with personal meaning, then that alerts the examiner that there's sort of a departure going on, where kind of the person's internal world might be encroaching too much on their ability to be objective, to see things more accurately.
Okay. So basically, you're not making a diagnosis, a clear diagnosis. It's indicating things which you will further evaluate. Is that what you're saying?
That is a really good point. All psychological instruments, like the Rorschach and many others that are used, are really not diagnostic tests. They're methods of understanding the different functions of the mind. There's a lot of cognitive tests and neuropsychological tests that help us understand memory and processing and concentration and things like that. Psychological tests that help us understand how a person reasons, how accurately they perceive, how much they can put themselves in another person's shoes, like empathy. So those are psychological functions. And then based on understanding something about how a person's mind works, we might look at history and then come up with a diagnosis. But the tests themselves don't tell us the diagnosis.
Okay, I got it.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it does. It does make sense. And, you know, in having a conversation with a patient, you may not get this depth of information they may not be forthcoming with the depth of information as they would if they're given something specific to answer or interpret.
Yes. In a direct conversation, in an interview situation, people can withhold because they're not comfortable disclosing, or people might not tell you things because they might not understand them. They might not be aware of them.
Okay.
One of the values of the Rorschach and a lot of other testing methods is that they help us, they tell us things that the patient or respondent can't tell us because they're unaware or because they are inhibited and don't want to share those things.
Okay. So what kind of disorders, emotional, mental disorders, have you seen based on the Engblot test, and how were their answers related to that? So in other words, you know, I know that you've probably diagnosed many different kinds of conditions, and can you cite an interesting, really interesting one that pointed to a particular diagnosis?
I think the problem is going through so many files in my mind where there are so many examples. Let me give you something from actually Hermann Rorschach's some of his early case examples.
Okay.
Of responses that were indicative of a disturbance in thinking.
Okay.
A patient looked at one of the blots and said, "This looks like the I can't remember the exact quote, the liver of a statesman." There's another adjective in there, but I can't pull it up right now. So this was a response where the person was seeing both the statement, the statesman, the person, a human, at the same time he was seeing a liver. They were sort of merged, condensed into one image, which is a severe kind of collapse of a boundary between two incompatible entities or frames of reference. A liver and a person are not cohabiting
right.
The same space. So this
right.
was a response, the liver of a, I wish I could think of the word, a noble statesman or something like that. There are a lot of, that's one of the things that's valuable about the Rorschach is it's a performance test. It's a problem-solving test. People have to do something. It's not answering questions on a questionnaire like the MMPI or something. So they look at ink blots and they tell you what it might be, and they talk, and you as the examiner has a rich sample of their verbalization. So that is certainly a way to study how people think and ways in which their thinking becomes disorganized or illogical. And those sorts of things can show up in responses on the ink blots. Other kinds of conditions besides disturbances in thinking, there are ways in which narcissistic organization can show up in one's responses, depressive, underpinnings, depressive feelings can be represented in one's responses. You might notice something here, Randy, with the way I'm responding to the questions. I'm trying to be careful because one of the things that we do as psychologists is that we are entrusted with trying to keep a certain amount of security around tests and test responses.
Okay.
The internet has completely turned that on its head. It used to be that, you know, the Rorschach cards themselves were designed to be kept secure and not in the public domain. Well, all of the blots are published on the internet, and there's a ton of information that's available about what responses mean, and a lot of times these are used by people who are involved in forensic situations, custody disputes, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So in my kind of hedging of my answers and not giving you too much of a explicit example, I think I'm maybe bending over backwards a little bit in the
okay.
Desire to be to be kind of careful.
Right, I understand. I
unfortunately
understand
probably not being all that clear.
That, well, you know, that's okay, and I get that. You know, I totally get that. Do you use this with every patient, or do you use it based on something you suspect in an interview, or something you pick up in an interview?
I don't use it with all the people I evaluate. I usually decide that I'm going to do it based on the conversation with the person who's referring their patient to me. And if there are lots of questions about, I don't understand my patient. I've had her in therapy for X number of months, and she's got some attentional problems, she's anxious, she's depressed, but something else seems to be going on. I want to find out just how depressed she is. I want to find out more about her, you know, her personality organization. So the Rorschach is really helpful in those kinds of referrals as a way of taking a deeper look into how someone structures their experience, how they think, how they reason, what kinds of models that they have in their mind in terms of self and others. So if I am referred somebody who has some school-related problems and there's no evidence of psychosocial concerns, I probably wouldn't do this, but I end up using it a lot. More than maybe 60% of the clients with whom I work.
Really? Well, that's
yeah.
pretty cool. So that is the psychoanalyst, because you're a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst. So psychoanalyst would be the evaluation through this kind of testing. Is that what a psychoanalyst?
Right.
That's what psychoanalysis is. Okay.
Psychoanalysis doesn't involve testing. There are those of us who are analysts and who do psychological testing, but most psychoanalysts are not psychologists who do testing. It's easy for people to kind of get confused between all these these professions that begin with psyche.
Psycho, right.
Yeah.
So what exactly is a psychoanalyst?
Well, it's an advanced level of training and practice, mostly psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. It used to be pretty much restricted to medical doctors, but over the last 30 or more years, the field has opened up. So there are a lot of social workers and psychologists and psychiatrists, and psychoanalysis as a form of therapy still exists. It's evolved quite a great deal since the 1920s and the era of Freud and so forth. It's really matured, and there's been a tremendous research in the past 50 years or so. There are practitioners who have very active analytic caseloads, which involve seeing people 3 and 4 times a week, maybe 5 times a week, over a period of years, often using the couch as it's portrayed historically. And this kind of treatment can be useful for people who have rather deep-seated or deeply entrenched character problems. Some of the people that you write about who have severe personality disorders, narcissistic disorders, may be helped by the right analyst with the right kind of training in this intensive treatment. A lot of other psychoanalysts don't do a lot of psychoanalysis per se, but they do psychotherapy based on psychoanalytic principles, trying to understand somebody at a deeper level.
Okay. I mean, that clears it up. Yeah, that does clear it up. Was there something in particular that got you interested in the field of psychology before you, actually embarked on this training and, schooling? And was there something particular that got you interested in this?
I'm trying to think back. I took some psychology classes in college. It seemed like a good fit. I was curious. I was interested in understanding people, but I think at a deeper level, I admit that I wanted to help people. And then over the years, I sort of stopped telling people that because it seemed like in graduate school, it was not very cool to say that you got into this field because you wanted to help people. It was better to say that you got into it because you wanted to study the mind or do research. But I think I remember very clearly feeling as though I wanted to help people. And I had a wonderful mother who was a nurse, and I think just filled me with goodness and that kind of desire to help. And I really attribute that to her.
That's amazing. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love hearing that someone had a really good mother that was a good influence.
Yes.
I don't hear that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I am really lucky. I think I struggled more with fathers, and I think that's pretty clear in the book that there's a struggle with fathers. And I didn't really know this until after I'd written the book, but my father is all over the book. I write about this in the acknowledgments. But my father's war experiences came to life in the book. He was a World War II combat veteran. But stories that I had heard him tell until my eyes glazed over, somehow I wrote this book in the last year of his life when he was dying. And there was sort of a magic that occurred, I think, with a lot of that stuff on my mind that found voice in the narrative of Anton's war experience. So there are several stories that are plucked right from things my father told me that he had experienced.
Yeah, my father was a World War II vet. And when you say he told him till your eyes glazed over, I can definitely relate to that. Oh, my gosh, years and years of the same stories.
But, you know, it's funny because when I was growing up and his world was so much wider, I never heard about this. He was a younger man. He was kind of living on the outside. And then as he got older, everything constricted. His friends were dying. He wasn't working. So he was reading a lot of books on World War II, and he was beginning to remember and started talking about things. And my sister and I heard these all the time as he got older. And I had really not been interested and, kind of socially, politically, kind of the obverse of my dad, but somehow the story seeped in, and I think the book in some ways is a homage to my father's, my dad, and my analyst. I had a wonderful analyst named Erwin Rosen, and he has inhabited a couple of the wiser characters in the book, and then Herman Rorschach, whom I of course never knew, but was sort of a professional father like figure. So
yeah, my father talked about it a lot, and you know, it dawned on me a couple of years ago that was his identity before he met my mother, who's a narcissist. And I believe that, she basically robbed him of his identity. She's 91 and he's 96, and they're still same dynamics.
Wow.
But I believe that his whole identity was based on the World War II and his experiences there, and I don't think he had a self. I think he lost a self over the years, over 75-some years. So that's why he was always talking about that. This is my interpretation of why that went on.
Well, that kind of helps me think about my dad a little bit in that light, that his identity, he always wore his World War II 36th Infantry ball cap, and he had some medals, some pins on it, but it really was a core part of his identity. And it seems like the other things in his life just sort of melted away, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a narcissistic mother. I'm writing another manuscript, another novel, and there's a key figure who's a very narcissistic mother, and so I'm going to write about the effect that's had on the the children. Yeah.
Oh, well, you're coming back. You're coming back because
okay.
I definitely want to know when that comes out. Let Connor know that that I said I want to see you again.
Okay.
I want to talk to you again.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Have you seen a lot of people with narcissistic personality disorder or the abused, those who have been victimized and abused by these people in your practice? Have you seen a lot of either or both?
Well, I've seen it in my practice all the time. And I see it every day when I turn on the television. And I think that that there's probably no better education for the public on narcissistic pathology dynamics, treatment as of people as objects, than what we've witnessed, and it's been, you know, playing on prime time. I think people have a real inside out kind of understanding of pathological narcissism. But your question, and that's
okay.
a uninvited sidebar, but yes, I very much in my practice, absolutely. People who were engaged in an abusive relationship with a narcissistic partner, or people who have a lot of narcissistic troubles themselves. Now, they often, folks like that won't come into treatment unless they get very depressed, and that can be the other kind of the other face of pathological narcissism is severe depression, where the person lives in two worlds. One is I'm the best, and then if something goes wrong, they're the worst, and
right.
can collapse into a profound depression. And
my understanding is that they don't stick around very long, and they tend to dismiss the therapist. As once the therapist begins to identify really who they are, that's their exit point. That's sort of when they leave.
Right.
Have you experienced that?
Oh, sure.
You can't tell a narcissist they're
absolutely.
A narcissist. Yeah.
Right. Without some small amount of self-reflective ability or self-awareness.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So your book is the 11th Inkblot, and I do highly recommend this story. It's just really fascinating. I'm not much of a historical fiction person, but you know, books come my way with every guest, and I get exposed to some amazing things that I would not normally have picked up. So, you know, this is just a great story. Jim, do you have a website?
I do. I'm in the process actually of having all my social media given a facelift, but my website is jhkleiger.com.
Okay, and Kleiger is Kleiger, jhkleiger.com. Okay, perfect.
Correct.
And your book is available through all the channels, I would imagine.
Right. I have an author's page on Amazon. The book's there. It's available in Kindle. Debating whether to put it on an audio, make an audio book, Amazon, and it's probably the best place to get it.
Okay, perfect. So in your writing of the next novel, if you need any information about a narcissistic mother from a point of view of someone who's experienced it, I'm here. Just give me a call.
Well, that's interesting. I will take you up on that because much of the book is going to be told through the voice of her daughter, who's a psychology professor.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, yep.
Yeah.
I'm here to help. Okay. I would love to help.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you so much. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you. It's been fun talking to you too. We really covered a lot of territory, but it's been great. So I'm available, and you know, maybe we'll touch base at some point in the future.
Well, I'd like that.
Yeah.
Be safe and stay well.
Yes, you too. All right. Well, it's been fun. Have a really great day. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show or any other show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. Let me see. I think this Friday is Free Advice Friday, where I take your calls and answer your questions. Yeah. July 10th. At 11 a.m. Eastern is the day that I take your calls and answer your questions about narcissistic abuse. If you have anything you want to share, that's a great time to do it. Other people do need to hear it. And I really do love when I get callers. Sometimes I don't, and then I have to do the whole thing. But if you have something to say, I would encourage you to call in. The number is 424-220-1801. The show is at 11 a.m. Eastern. If for some reason you're not available to call in at that time, you can email me your comment or question to loveyourlife@randyfine.com, and I will answer that on air. Other people will love to hear what you have to say. Trust me, it really helps to hear other people. I mean, here you can, if you listen to this interview, you can hear how my experience is helping someone who has tremendous amount of experience and credentials. So, you know, we all help each other. Anyway. That's the end of the show. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.